back. Welcome. Today we are doing a case study. It's the fiction case study in this room. And we have the honor of having Shobha Rao with us. She's the author of Girls Burn Brighter. And we're just going to start with a quick reading from her, and then we'll I'll introduce them further. But yeah, Shobha, take it away.
Great. Such a pleasure to be here. You can hear me? I'm just going to read from the very beginning of the novel, so there's really no explanation needed. The most striking thing about the temple near the village of Indravalli was not readily apparent. No, one had to first climb the mountain and come close. One had to take a long, thoughtful look at the entrance, at the door. Not at its carved panels or its fine graining, but at how the door stood so brave and so luminous and so alone. How it seemed to stand strong and tall, as if still a tree. It was the wood, lumbered from a grove of trees northwest of Indravalli. The grove was cultivated by an old woman, they said, more than 100 years old, who was childless. She and her husband had been farmers, and when she'd come to understand that she would never have children, she'd started planting trees as a way to care for something, as a way to nurture something fragile and lovely. Her husband had surrounded the young saplings with thorny bushes to keep out wild animals, and it being a dry region, she'd had to carry water from many kilometers away to water them. Their grove now boasted hundreds of trees, all of them steady and swaying in the dry wind. A journalist from a local newspaper once went to interview the old woman. He arrived at tea time, and he and the old woman sat in the shade of one of the trees, its wide leaves rustling high above them. They sipped their tea soundlessly. Even the journalist, forgetting all of his questions, was overcome by the quiet green beauty of the place. He had heard of her childlessness and her recently dead husband, and so, to be delicate, he said, "They must keep you company, the trees." The old woman's gray eyes smiled, and she said, "Oh yes, I'm never lonely. I have hundreds of children." The journalist saw an opportunity. "So you see them as children? Don't you?" she said. There was silence. The journalist took a long, deep look into the grove of trees, their thick trunks, their strength, despite drought and disease and insects and floods and famine, and yet shining with gold-green light, radiant even in the heat and heaviness of afternoon. "You're a fortunate woman," he said, "to have so many sons." The old woman looked up at him, her eyes on fire, her wrinkled face taking on the glow of her girlhood. "I am fortunate," she said, "but you are mistaken, young man. These aren't my sons, not one. These," she said, "are my daughters." Thank you.
Oh, I just got goosebumps. Thank you. I'm Montana Ogti Studier. I'm the Director of Membership and Development at CLMP. And so, again, we have Shobha Rao here and her editor, Amy Einhorn. Sorry, I was going to say Einhart. Amy Einhorn. And we're going to start with you, Shobha, and talk about your path to writing this book as a writer before it was a book, when it was just in your mind. And I'm going to start with, is this the book you started writing?
Oh, we're going to just excavate at this point. No, I had been writing for 15 years with absolutely no publications. I have 4 novels tucked away in my computer, my desk drawer. And I then started writing short stories because I wanted to rethink what I was writing and how I was writing, and maybe step back and say, look, maybe if I learned and taught myself the short story and started maybe publishing in literary journals. Maybe I can sort of approach this whole process that way. And so I started writing short stories, and then that got me in touch with Amy, ultimately, and we can get into that later. And she asked me to write the novel, which is what Girls Burn Brighter became, is the novel she asked me to write. So no, this was absolutely not the sort of first work by any stretch of the imagination.
And your first work that was published was a book of short stories, a short story collection.
Yes, An Unrestored Woman, and that was published in 2016.
And I think that's important for you guys to hear, because also last night we talked with Nana about his book, which is short stories as well. And I think it's a misconception that short stories don't sell, or don't sell as a whole. You know, you can sell them individually, but we have two people that we've just seen whose first work out in the world is a work, collection of short stories. So were you writing those, any of them, with the idea of changing them into a novel, or were they always all short stories?
You know, I don't know, as a writer, I don't know that one can write a short story thinking it will be a novel one day, or vice versa. I mean, I think a short story is such a complete form unto itself. And so I cannot imagine trying to compress a novel into a short story, hoping it grows into that one day, or the reverse, quite honestly. So to answer your question, no, every short story was complete. There was no sort of motive to expand it or contract it later. It was as delivered into the world.
And when you were writing those short stories, at what point did you feel like you had like a critical mass of enough short stories to approach someone in regards to publishing them?
So I was taking classes in an MFA program, and through that program, I met somebody who's actually an English professor. He wasn't even in the creative writing department. And I mentioned to him that I had some short stories, and I had been writing, you know, I might have had like two or three at that point. And he read one, he liked it, and he said, "Look, come to me when you have a collection." So I held him to his word. 2.5 years later, I went back, and he didn't see me the whole time. I went back and knocked on his door, and I said, "Remember me?" And so I knew it was about, you know, I wanted about a dozen, just seemed like a nice number. And so I was building up to that. And then when I had that, I reapproached a professor.
I'm going to grab onto that for a second, because I think that oftentimes if you are approached by someone who says, "Send me your work," and you don't feel like you have enough or the right kind of work to send them right then, there is the idea that, well, I've let too much time lapse. I'm not going to reach out to them then, because they asked me a year ago or 6 months ago or 3 years ago to send me something, and now there's no way they would remember me. It's been too long. I'm not going to send them stuff. But they actually do want, they know that you're a writer. They do want your work, and they know that it takes time. So this is great. So it was how many years?
2.5.
2.5. And yeah. Then you go back and you're like, "Here, this is right what you wanted to see."
Yeah. And I think as writers, I mean, it's such a hard industry to break into, that you just can't have any ego or shame around it. I mean, you just be like, you know, I'm like, make them remember you. And I looked him in the eye and I said, "You will see me again." Because I have worked far too long and far too hard to let go of, you know, this very, like, at the time felt like a very fragile contact. But it was still something that I promised myself I would follow up on. Because, you know, the universe is not always so generous. And so in the moment that it is, you know, absolutely.
Grab it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, perfect. And then so you gave him your short stories.
I did. I just plunked the collection down, and he's like, no, I know you can write. Just send it to this friend I have. He did me the great, honor of actually giving me her home address. So I leapfrogged over the slush pile in her office, and because they were good friends. And once I mailed to her, it was not automatic. I waited, as we all must. It took a couple of months. And in the couple of months, I ended up winning the Catherine Ann Porter Prize for one of the stories. So I wrote to her immediately and I said, "By the way, as you're considering my work, you know, I won this prize, just to let you know." Within an hour, my phone rang. And she said, I want to take you on as my client. So clearly there was hesitation on her part, or maybe some sort of, she was thinking it over or whatever. And I think the winning the prize kind of put her over the edge, and she ended up being my agent.
Did you apply to a lot of prizes within that time, or was this the only one?
This is actually the only one. I am so suspicious of prizes because they're so expensive to enter. And we all know this. There's like $25, $30 entry fees. And a friend of mine had convinced me to enter this one. And I said, no, I don't want to do that. I think they just take our money and don't actually look at, our work. But then she talked me into it. And so, again, sort of the great good fortune of having the right story, enter the right contest, and the right judge, who was Chris Abani, and he picked my story. So again, I had been submitting to journals, and I had gotten a few publications, and the prize, entering prizes, I understand it can be financially, a real financial commitment. So really choose which prizes you're going to enter. Don't just do this huge, don't spend hundreds of dollars. Just very carefully choose the prizes that you want to enter that maybe perhaps have picked work like yours in the past.
So then you had an agent.
I had an agent.
All right. So then at that point, you had your short stories. You had an agent. Where did you go from there?
So we worked on tightening up some of the short stories. Spent, just took maybe a few weeks, a couple months doing that. And then then once it was ready, they do a lot of plotting on the agent's end that I'm not really sure about when to send it out. And then she sent me a list of the 10 publishing houses that she was going to send it to. But then they had, she had two more lists of 10, right? So she had 30. But then what she did was send to the first 10. If they all said no, then we would go to the next 10 and so forth. But fortunately, I found Amy through that first 10, list. So again, I think the agent, from what I know, does a lot of catering to, which editors would like this work. And perhaps Amy can speak more to that, but, that's from what I know.
Great. Yeah. So Flatiron Books was on that first top 10 list. That's exciting.
It is.
So Amy, bringing you in, did this come onto your desk? How big is Flatiron? Let's start with there.
So actually, I'm just remembering all of this now. You were the first person I bought. So I had switched jobs. I had had an imprint at Penguin, my own eponymous imprint at Penguin. I had switched. I had just come over to Flatiron. And so Shoba's collection was the first thing I bought. So up until I got there, Flatiron had started as a new publishing division. Some of you might not have even heard of it. It's one of the newest divisions of Macmillan. Had started as nonfiction and was doing things like Oprah Winfrey. And then I came and we started doing fiction. So up until that, we hadn't been doing fiction.
Okay.
So the list was really small at that point because there was no title.
How many editors are at Flatiron?
Now, that's a good question. I believe there's 8 editors.
Okay. And then?
Oh, then there were 4.
Okay. So when something comes in through the door, do you guys have to kind of fight it out or?
No. So they're not submitting to the company as a whole. They're submitting to the editor. And so, for instance, Sandy, can you guys hear me?
Maybe speak
sorry,
into.
I'm sorry, can you hear me now? So they're not submitting to the company. They're submitting to an editor in particular. So I would guess that Sandy sent it to me because I have a weakness for short stories. I had done a couple previously. So that's what a good agent will do is that, for instance, if she sent that to one of my colleagues, they would be like, I do nonfiction. Why are you sending me a collection of short stories?
Lovely. And yeah, this is something that we've talked about yesterday and we're going to talk about again today is the relationship you have with the people that are on your team is the most important thing that you can have. If you, get an agent and you think that that's great because that's what you've been aiming for, but your agent doesn't understand you, isn't in your corner, they won't know who to send it to. They won't see your work the way you see it and they won't be able to send it to the exact editor who's going to say yes. Perfect. So thank you for saying that. Yeah, it doesn't go to the entire house. It just goes to an editor who is the editor that's going to say yes. Great. So it came across your your desk.
And so in my, I think that it was sold as a collection of short stories and a novel.
Yeah.
So that, so I should say, as much as I would love for all of you to feel encouraged to do short stories are just, the reality is they're harder to sell. The marketplace is harder. For every jump of Lahira, there's 100 more that you haven't heard of. Usually a major publishing house will take on a short story collection if they know that there's a novel coming. It's rare that you're just going to buy a short story collection by itself.
So did you have a novel in the works, Shoba?
She did. No, so I remember the conversation. Do you remember? This is such a funny, just funny conversation, because what happened is Amy asked for a novel, and I said, I don't remember what I said, but then I came back to you and I said, you know what? I got nothing. I don't know what to write about. And so Amy said, well, why don't you write about this? And you know, it doesn't even matter what it was, because I ended up writing about it, and that novel was eminently mediocre. I mean, just not, it wasn't working at all. And I sent it to Amy thinking, well, maybe she'll, you know, help me edit through the, and she just got on the phone. She's like, No, this isn't working. This isn't working. And, you know, I think it just both dawned on us that you can't tell a person what to write, right? I mean, that it has to come from some very deep, haunted place inside of us. And so we were just like, okay, I'm going to not tell you what to write. I'm going to send you back out. Come back to me in a year. And so that's how Girls Burn Brighter came to be. So there was definitely a novel before that that did not work on any level.
How much time did you put into that one?
Probably about a year. Yeah.
A year. So you had the short story collection. The house had bought a short story collection and a novel with the assumption that a novel was coming. You worked on this novel for a year. It was terrible.
Yes.
You worked on this then for another year.
Uh-huh.
And then how much of this was written by the time you came back with it and said, here you go, here's a manuscript?
So I completed it. Yeah. So, because I knew at this point, I knew I couldn't, I knew as a writer and as a person that I didn't want to go back and say, oh, let me give you, you know, half of a manuscript. I needed to complete a work and hand it in. And I knew I could do it. And, it wasn't actually written in, over the course of a year. I actually wrote it in 2 months. Because I was so powered by like this engine inside of me that said, no, write the story of these two girls and make it absolutely true and honest to who I am. And so once I sat down, it just poured out of me. And that's the fairy tale aspect of this whole thing. But I understand it took 17 years to get to the 2 month fairy
the two
tale
months.
Moment.
Yeah. I'm not mistaken that in the novel that we said they're going to put in the shelf, there was the genesis of this in there.
Yes. So there was, in the novel, very, very awful novel that I sent to Amy, there was about 20 pages, 20 to 30 pages where I explored this friendship, between these two girls. And, you know, it was a, kind of an aside, not really critical to the story, but both Amy and my agent, Sandy, when we were having the, you know, conversation of, you know, destroy this novel that you just wrote, they both said, but that friendship with those two girls, that's interesting. Do you want to maybe explore that a little bit more deeply? And so I understood that those 20, 30 pages are what resonated out of a 300-page work that I'd submitted.
And also, though, that some of that, if I'm not spilling anything, might end up using in another novel. There was a portion of that. Am I wrong?
Oh, we might need to talk about that. I don't remember.
I think it's, we'll talk later, but yeah. I think actually part of that ends up being in what you're working on next.
I know exactly what you're saying. We'll talk about it. Yeah. And it's so funny because in the 20, 30 page excerpt, one of the, I had written it so that one of the girls in the friendship died. And both Amy and Sandy were like, resurrect this girl. She is so interesting. And she ended up becoming Savita, who's one of the main characters.
Yeah. That's exciting. Yeah. Amy, how many pages did it take when she sent this to you to feel like, yes, wow, this is it. You did it.
Oh, I think, I mean, to be honest, like, hearing her read the opening, I mean, I don't know about you, I still get chills when she reads that, so you just sort of know she nailed it. Which I should say, usually when you're having that kind of difficult conversation telling an author this isn't working, and then they send you something back in, it's extremely rare that they send it back in and that it's almost ready to put. Like, usually they send it back in and you're like little baby steps to try and make it something. It was complete night and day.
Lovely. How many rounds of edits did you go through with this?
I don't know. Maybe three or four. There was just one character named Mohan who wasn't quite. I couldn't quite get him right. I couldn't quite figure out his motivations for certain things he does in the course of the novel. It wasn't hitting true, to his sort of role in the novel. So yeah, we went back and forth with him a few times. So maybe three or four.
And the ending,
yeah, which I love. I love the ending, but it took some time to balance, I think, sort of this magical realism element that it has, or perhaps has, and just how much information I was going to give the reader without leaving them frustrated. So, that's a fine balancing act. So we went back and forth on that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Shobi, you said earlier that putting a book out there is like putting your soul out into the world. How does it feel? How do you deal with someone coming back with edits on that? How and what kind of conversation, this is between the two of you, what kind of conversation do you have with an editor the first time you meet or the second time or when you decide ultimately to work together forever to talk about what that relationship is going to be like and how comfortable you both are?
So when Amy, expressed interest in my work with the short stories, I think we ended up having a conversation on the phone before the collection was bought, just to see if we got along. I don't know if this is a typical thing that happens, but I've heard of it in other situations. So we had a conversation on the phone, and it was just great. It was, it felt like I have somebody I had known for a long time, but even more importantly, it felt like, we would give each other enough space to sort of bring the work to its best place, to its best form. And so I was looking for, somebody who wouldn't say, this is it, dictatorial, you've got to do this. And I won't speak for Amy what she was looking for in the author she speaks to, but certainly just a kind of, space and encouragement around the work without being obsequious or saying, oh yeah, no, I'll do everything you say. So, just getting along and sort of a deep respect and trust for each other. And that was pretty apparent as soon as we got on the phone.
And Amy, how many of your edits do you feel like need to be taken and used in order to have a good relationship with an author? If they're very, if they won't hear it, obviously you can't work with them, but how much is enough? How much is too much?
I think it really depends on every case is different. I have some authors who, if you put in a comma, it's like a 15-minute conversation about why is there a comma there? Should there be a comma there? And then there are other people who are like doing everything, like literally. So then there's people in the middle who are like, I don't agree with this, but I want to do this. I have a nonfiction memoirist, humor writer, Jenny Lawson, and I remember someone asked her about the editing process, and she said, it's great. It's basically like you spend like 9 months creating this baby, and you hand this baby to your editor, and your editor's like, your baby is so unbelievably cute. I'm just going to cut off its legs and cut off its arms, and it's going to be so much cuter. And I will say usually, and also editors are all different. There's some editors who aren't at all hands-on, who aren't editing, who are just sort of buying and being like, this is great, I'm putting it into production. I tend to have conversations with my authors before I will buy their books, because I always say it's kind of like a Mormon marriage in terms of, we're going to be together for the next couple years. We should make sure if we don't have the same vision for what the novel is, as much as I might love it, I'm probably not the person to publish it. And Shoba wouldn't be happy if I had gotten on the phone and said, this is everything you're going to do, and there's no conversation about it, then I wouldn't have been the right person for her.
Wonderful. Okay. So then tell me about the process then. Once you've had it edited, once you're ready to go, what's that process like to get your book actually published?
Emotionally, do you mean?
Sure, yeah, let's start with that.
Well, I have to tell you that the first time, and this is with the short stories, a box arrived with the book. You know, they send you like 20 copies or whatever. I ran upstairs in my building and I just like opened it and I just stared at it and I just dropped to my knees. I was just like, it just was the most overwhelming emotional moment. I can't express to you the sort of, you know, passage in my own life and just the kind of revolutions that had to happen in order to get to that moment and how incredibly life-changing it was. And here's the thing. I think, you know, it's a deeply personal moment. And I guess no other, you know, it goes out into the world, but that moment, to go keep going with the baby analogy, is that first moment before you're the only person to see that baby, and that's it. And whatever happens after, so much of the world is going to influence the reviews, the critics, you know, whatever. But that moment is yours, and it's pure, and it's perfect. And so after that, there was a huge learning curve regarding, you know, coming to terms with bad reviews or not so great reviews, and just seeing that, oh wow, short story collections don't sell that well. That's sobering. And you know, things like just the world enters into that sort of pure moment. And that's okay. It should. But you should also have that moment. So it continues to be an incredible journey. Because with the novel, it felt like a lot more people were reading it. And it felt like I was getting a lot more feedback and input and reviews. And so it felt like I'd opened the door wider. And I think it's going to continue to be that, you know, constantly opening the door a little bit wider and taking in as much as I can and letting the other stuff that I you know, and I've come to a place actually where I don't even read the reviews that are bad. I just skim them and I keep going. Skim them and I keep going. Because that is self-preservation. And that's saying, no, I put the best work out there I possibly could. And no one is going to tell me otherwise.
And a lot of times when they're the bad reviews, it's that they just don't get the book.
Yeah, as it turns out.
It's not as though that, I mean, I had this conversation with another author recently where they were saying that they want to read the reviews even if they're bad because they think that could help them in terms of their writing. But a lot of times if a review's really bad, it's because the reviewer just really inherently didn't get what the book was. Mm-hmm. And I think then there's nothing constructive you can kind of take from it.
Right. And I found that out too, the hard way. But you know, it's as you are a writer in the world, as I continue to be, my sort of sense of self and confidence, you know, is still obviously beholden to like this ebbs and flows. But the core of you sort of strengthens and gains confidence. And that's been part of the journey as well.
So it is very emotional on the side of the author.
Yes.
Amy, on your side, once you have a book that is all set, what's the process like in your bubble to get it published, working with your team and the publicist and working to get it out there into the world?
So up until we have a finished manuscript, it's almost as if the editor and the writer are sort of in this bubble where it's just this sort of very close team, and then there's sort of nobody else around who's really looking at it. Usually even the agent a lot of times isn't necessarily reading every draft. But then once we're sort of saying, okay, this is it, then in a way that's where the whole publishing house comes into the process. So there's production process, which is it's going to copy editing, and you have a copy that's going to be all the stuff that you guys probably don't pay attention to, but we do, which is Shoba's name going to be on the top of the page of the interior? Is it going to be in the bottom? What's the font we're using? You know, is it sans serif? Is it, you know, what's the letting? All that kind of stuff. I'm giving it to my art director who's coming up with cover designs. And that's when also sort of I have usually even before we're finished, my marketing team and my publicity team are figuring out what's our plan. So they're saying, what's the best time for us to be publishing this? What is the plan going to look like in terms of publicity for short stories? Those are hard. But does that make sense in terms of do we bring Shoba to certain places where we think if you have Shoba in a room full of people, I dare anyone not to want to read her book afterwards because she's such a great speaker. So there's sort of a bunch of all of that starts happening. And then also, frankly, working with the sales department, I need my sales force to read the book because they then need to hand sell it to the booksellers. There's interacting. I'm writing to booksellers saying, I really think you would like this. Can you read it? Can you nominate it for Indie Next? So there's a kind of a lot of different balls that are being juggled.
And that's your job to reach out to booksellers.
It is my job, yeah.
And what was your agent doing during this? What's her role?
I think her job was done. Yeah. In fact, I don't think Sandy read the novel until it came out. So she, you know, I work with Amy. I sent the novel exclusively to Amy once I'd written it because she had contracted me to write the novel. And I never even sent it to Sandy, and she didn't read it.
I think she did, but I will say, look, yeah. An agent's job is to make sure that I'm doing my job. So the agent's job is to place the book at the best place where the best editor and the best publishing house that they think will do a good job. And then an agent, in a way, it's a good thing that Sandy wasn't doing much because it meant that I was doing my job. But if, for instance, Sandy was saying, you know, we haven't heard anything in terms of, you know, for the novel, Shoba, you know, we sent you out to, you know, you did a tour of the West Coast. There was a lot of stuff going on. So I'm keeping Sandy apprised of that. Had that not been happening, I would have gotten a call from Sandy saying, I'm not hearing anything. What's going on?
Exactly. Okay. Thank you. That's exactly what I was looking for. We've had a lot of talking with agents in the past day and today. So it's nice to have an editor here to see that then transitions into a different relationship once you're actually working on a book and your agent kind of steps back and is in the background.
And I should say, it just as editors are different, agents are different. You know, we're publishing a novel next year with an agent who has – he has solicited quotes from booksellers. He's getting us blurbs. I mean, we're doing it with him. But just there's all different kind of – and Sandy did. You know, Sandy helped us get to certain people. Mm-hmm. So it's just sort of – there are certain agents who they sell you the book and you never hear from them again. And that might be fine for a certain kind of author. There are certain agents who are, I'm going to read the first draft before I send it to the editor. I mean, they're all different.
I'm going to backtrack just a little bit and talk about the editing, as an editor, when you give notes to your author, how long do you expect to not hear back from them when they are putting those edits into place?
I don't want to hear back from them for a while. I mean, because I think the worst thing is when someone says, oh, you know, I got your editorial letter, here's the revised manuscript, and it's a week or two later. Like, that means that they just didn't actually do it thoughtfully. So, and usually we have a conversation about that. It was sort of like, I'll send an editorial letter. It takes, you know, you don't have a conversation with them the next day because, in a way, Shoba needs to process everything. We might have a conversation in a week, and then I'll say to her, so I want you to sort of go and think about how long you want, because what I need to know is, oh, if Shoba's going to take 6 months to revise, I'm going to give us another month or two to go back and forth, then I have a sense of when I can publish the book. But I don't...
But you do want it to percolate in their brains and not just for them to, like, regurgitate what you said exactly.
I always say, like, I need it to marinate, yeah.
Nice. Perfect. Okay, let me check time really fast. Okay, I think we're going to open it up to questions because we might have a lot of them. And then if we don't, then I'll go back into chatting with you guys. But let's open it up to questions. And then, Raph, will you hand the microphone to people? We're going to go with this woman to start in the pink.
Hi.
It's like a comedy sketch.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. I have two questions. The first one, I'm wondering about when you spoke about, you know, the contracting and that you'd bought two books, and then there's the two-year process that happened afterwards to make that second book happen. I wonder about the finances and all that. When you say you bought two books, like, you paid for, I guess, two advances, and I wonder, like, does that, like, were you, not to get into specifics, but just, like, are you given, like, cost of living at that point? Do you have to work? Are you able to? Because I just think about, like, a year to turn around a book. Like, if I'm working, it's not going to happen. Right. And so I just, like, I wonder about the financial process of how that comes to life.
Well, first of all, I should say, as much as there are all these authors who we think of who are big best-selling authors, don't go into publishing because you want to make a lot of money. Because if you amortize it, it's not a very, you know, it's not a lot of money in terms of, even if, let's just say you got crazy lucky and you got $500,000 for a novel. If you've worked on that novel for 10 years, you know, like, it's just not. So, but in terms of what happens is, so it used to be the reason we have advances, right, back in the day was because an author needed something to live on to write their books. You would give them money, and that was called their advance. Now, frankly, my sort of worst fear is when my authors call me and say, and I quit my job because I know that all of your authors are big best-selling authors. And I'm like, oh, my God. So normally what you do, a typical contract is I will give you whatever the advance is. So let's just say that I paid you $10 for the book. Hopefully you'd get more than $10, but let's just say you got $10, right? I give you a quarter of that on signing. So I'm going to give you $2.50 on signing. I'm going to give you money when you deliver. So it's called delivery and acceptance. So not the first time Shoba hands in the manuscript, because we need to go back and forth, and if I give you the money, sometimes people are like, I'm done, you paid me. So after we decide, no, it's finished and it goes into production, I give you that second quarter, then I give you a quarter on hardcover publication, and then a quarter on paperback publication.
Okay. So then all that, like, the time deadlines is negotiated around, like, when I could feasibly do that with a job, because obviously you'd still need a job.
Look, there, you know, if you were doing a nonfiction book that was tying into, you know, the 100th anniversary of such and such is happening, you really need to hit that deadline because you have a certain window and you can publish it. Most novels, you know, there's no specific time we have to publish them by, and at the end of the day, what really matters is the novel. So rushing somebody to finish something, unless you're a huge best-selling author and they're in a book a year schedule where there is that kind of, they have an urgency because they have a momentum, et cetera, et cetera. For something like this, there was no reason for me to say to Shoba, but you need to turn it around in 3 months, because I can't rush greatness, right? Yeah.
Thank you. And then my other question was around, you were talking about the production experience. How much does an author have, like, rights to an opinion around, like, the typesetting, the font, the paperweight, the cover art, things like that?
So I send my designs to the authors because I always feel, again, using the baby analogy, they've worked this hard, and then all of a sudden if they're going to open their book and be like, oh, my God, I hate sans serif. That's horrible. Why didn't someone ask me? So we'll send the design. So and then Shoba and her agent will weigh in. Paperweight, to be honest, rarely, because it's really expensive. And, for instance, my company tends to be very environmentally conscious. So if you're using a higher paperweight, the head of my company could tell you how many more forests end up dying because of being cut down because of that. But, for instance, if you were doing a book of photographs, you'll notice those are a heavier paper. If you guys noticed 2 years ago that Obama photography book, and it went out of stock for a really long time during the holidays, in the contract, I believe, was that it had to be printed in Italy. And so because the photographer was very specific about what kind of paper that had to be on and how the book looked. He's a photographer, so that makes sense, but that was something he negotiated when he was doing his contract. Most fiction writers are rarely asking me. They might just say, I'd like it to be a nice paper where I can't see through it.
Shoba, how many covers did you see and turn down?
With Girls Burn Brighter, the first one, I mean, it was just incredible. How can you not be drawn to this cover in a bookstore? And in fact, whenever I walk into a space that has multiple books, my eye immediately, and I swear it's not because it's my book, it just immediately is drawn to the book. But with the short story collection, An Unrestored Woman, we went back and forth a couple of times. I just didn't want it to have like a cliche Indian woman on the cover. And, you know, so it was a little bit of back and forth on that. Not that that's what they gave me, but, you know, I had specific sort of ideas in my mind. And they did eventually match up with what the cover that was presented to me. But there was a little bit back and forth on that.
Okay, great. Next question? Yes. Go around that way.
After you had gotten the short stories agreement, Amy asked for a novel, and you said, I don't have one. But you mentioned you had four on your laptop. Why didn't you use one of those?
You know, I think this is the exquisite journey of a writer, right? We write them and we think they're so great, and then fast forward, what, a month or a year or 10 years, and you think, wait, this isn't as good as I thought, because you've grown as a writer, hopefully. And you look back on the work and it's, you know, it's a sort of, you know, relic of who your growth, but it's not right anymore, right? And so I did. I went back to all four and I sort of started reading them, and I thought, no, this isn't who I am as a writer anymore. But if you happen to have one on your computer that fits the bill, you reread it and think, wow, this is fantastic. I'll just submit this. You know, kudos to you. That, you know, that novel has this enduring quality. None of the ones, they were all practice novels. They were all just me sort of developing and learning the craft. And so they weren't quite up to what I wanted from myself as a writer anymore. And I had to be honest about that with myself.
Are you writing another novel right now?
Not right this instant, but it's soon to be the case. probably since I'm teaching the semester, I'm just going to hold off. And as soon as the semester ends, then it begins.
Amy, how soon after a novel is like done, do you ask the author, hey, what's next? What you working on?
That's very... difficult conversation. Because also the weird thing is sort of Shoba finishes Girls Burn Brighter, and then almost a year goes by, and then she gets completely pulled back in terms of doing publicity. And so you're sort of back in it. And so it's very hard, I think, for you should speak to this more, if you're working on something else, to sort of then be pulled out of that. And so I do think it's hard. And you also, it's hard to go to someone and say, so you've done all this for us. Now, where's the next thing? And again, I think you have to be conscious of what Shoba does or what writers do is something that I can't teach and I can't, like, you can't manufacture. So it really has to come where Shoba says to me, look, if I don't hear from her for a year, I will check in and being like, hi, I'm not nudging. I just want to see how things are going. But to say, like, where's the next one? And also, that's just not the track she's on. I mean, she's a literary writer. It was different if we were saying, like, she's writing the next, you know, unreliable narrator, psychological thriller. There's a girl in the title. There's a girl in the title. it's sort of apples and oranges than what she's doing.
Do you have a contract, though? Or is it based on the assumption or faith that you will stay with the same publishing house?
No, we have another contract.
And how soon was that signed?
Now I can't remember. It was at some point before this published?
I want to say early this summer, which had been
right after. Okay.
And I have to say, Amy was in, different people approach the writer in different ways and they put different amounts of pressure. So Amy was just, you know, she just sort of said, okay, she's doing the publicity stuff, we'll let her do it. But Sandy, my agent, I love her to death. Pretty much a week after it came out, she's like, so what's next? I'm like, what do you mean? I'm exhausted. And so, you know, just so in this process, but I understood what she was saying. She said, you know, don't get locked into this start, keep thinking. You know, don't just sort of like, you know, be frozen in the place of, you know, enjoy the publicity, you know, enjoy the book tours and all that, but understand that, you know, your journey continues. Let's do this. And so I put her off for a little bit, and I thought, no, I do want to start thinking about my next work. And then she had me write what's called a précis, and we worked on that a little bit, and she, once it, we felt like it was ready, she sent it to Amy, and Amy bought, gave me a contract based on that.
Great, thank you. Next question? Yes.
Yeah, so I actually have a quick question since you mentioned, like, girl in the title, like, the process of the title, whether this is the title that you always wanted for this book or whether, I mean, I understand that, like, whatever title an author comes up with is, like, going to be, like, it's also a marketing thing, that the title. So I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about the process for titling for you and how you go about thinking about titles. I think titles are horrifying. So I don't know if you find them very easy, but I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about the title.
I find them extraordinarily difficult. I don't have yet to title one of my works. I think both of them, Amy was like, how about this? I was like, okay, great. I'll go with it. I'm just really bad. I can't imagine sort of distilling, you know, a novel or short stories into two or three words, five words on the outside. So I really need a lot of help with it, and that's when Amy came in, and maybe you can talk more about the actual process of titling, but for me, it's really difficult, so it was good to just hand it off, and An Unrestored Woman, it's obviously, you know, one of the titles of the stories in the collection, and then this one, for Girls Burn Brighter, you know, we didn't have a title, I submitted without a title, and so we sat down, you know, in our different coasts, and I just went through the book and tried to lift, you know, maybe phrases or, you know, some element that sort of stood off the page, words within the novel that sort of, you know, sort of rose up and in some way stuck out. And I had a line where I said, you know, Savita, burn brighter. And that kind of hit me, maybe the alliteration. And so I sent Amy a list of, you know, maybe 20 things I found, possibilities. And she fell in love with the Girls Burn Brighter, I think.
Yeah. But it's hard because we just had this conversation. You could have, if you have, all of a sudden you have 20 titles, even if there's a great title in there, you start looking at them and you're like, I don't, like, they all start sounding the same, or they're sort of just, they lose their power when they're on a list. So titles are really, really hard. And you either sort of have it at the beginning, or I've been working with authors for 5 years on a novel and we still don't have the title, and you just keep saying, it's going to come, don't worry, and it does. Usually, and it usually comes from reading something in the novel, or, you know, what I'll say to them is just write and we'll figure it out. And then as I'm editing, I'll be on the lookout for something that resonates. And usually it'll happen like what happened with Shoba, where something will come out and we'll say that's what the book is.
Have you ever had an author who was dead set on a terrible title?
That's a good question. No, I don't think I have, but now I feel like I will.
Yeah. Cursed you, sorry.
Jinx. Yes.
Good morning. Can you tell us about the publicity journey for a debut author?
It depends. You mean for a fiction writer?
Correct.
You know, it's really hard these days. I think, you know, again, I have authors who sort of, they sign their contract and they're like, I'm quitting my job. And you're going to send me out on a book tour, which is kind of like, if this was 1980, we would be sending you out on a book tour, but it's not 1980. And so you send people out, and, you know, I remember one of my authors called and they said, well, there were 4 people there in the audience and 2 people were homeless. So, you know, you have to start thinking, does it make sense? Like, if you're going, nobody knows who this person is, so what's the point of sending them out? So we tend not to do that. Review coverage, if you think about it, I believe the New York Times now is the only freestanding book review left for a major newspaper. That said, there's a lot more online, obviously, all of these places that BuzzFeed, like, none of those places existed, right?
But it used to be for publicity that you could sort of have this holy grail of if you got the Boston Globe, the New York Times, NPR, Washington Post, Dallas Morning News, you were like, those are it. It's not the case anymore. So, you know, people can't really speak to what makes a book work. So you could say things like NPR sells books. That definitely does. Terry Gross sells books. I've had books in the New York Times Book Review that do nothing. It used to be that if you were on the Today Show that sold, not necessarily anymore. Today Show very rarely would have a first-time debut author anyway for fiction. What we'll do is a lot more of seeding of independent booksellers. So even though independents are smaller in number than they used to be, they're disproportionately influential, and I always view them as sort of the tail that wags the dog. So we'll send, you know, Shobo, we send out to independent booksellers where we want them hand-selling the book. They have something called Indie Next, which is where they vote, and they sort of pick a book, a bunch of books per month that they think are sort of the ones that they're most excited about. We will send Shobo, I believe we sent to, there's something called Regional BE. So our big conference is Book Expo, and then you have Regional Book Expo. So there's like a Northern California Independent Bookseller Association where I believe, I don't know if you did that.
I went to the American Library Association midwinter conference where they just picked, they had like five debut authors there that the Library Association had picked, which is so incredible, such an honor, because librarians had picked it. So that was sort of the build up before the book, and then.
And sometimes some of these don't work in terms of timing, where you might be, oh, well, you know, we have an author who would make sense to send to the Southern Independent Bookseller Association, but their meeting's in September, and if their book is coming out in July, that's not going to work. So it's a bunch of that. Then we have publicity who is sort of really trying to send it out everywhere and trying to get people to pay attention. And then there's marketing, which I will say, I think we probably spend more on marketing than ever before. Because all of those things that you're seeing online, which look like they're free, are not necessarily free. And also things which I'm not sure everyone realizes, like when you walk into a Barnes & Noble, if a book is on a table, we're paying for, you know, there's co-ops, so we're paying for that. So it's not, they ultimately are choosing, but it's not as if sort of like, oh, isn't this, you know, it's all sort of where you walk in, you're in the bookstore. If you're in an airport and you see all those displays, all of that are paid for by the publisher.
Great, thank you. Someone from this side of the room? Yes, in the front here.
Wait.
Oh, sure. I love talking about the 2 months.
Could everybody hear the question?
Yeah.
Oh, I asked if she could talk more about the 2 month period during which she actually wrote the novel and what that was like.
Yeah, so I was sitting in my apartment in San Francisco, and, you know, as you all know, I had submitted a novel that didn't work. And so here I'm sitting back to the blank screen that we're all so familiar with, and nothing was coming. I mean, I was just so distraught that the first one hadn't worked that I submitted, and there's all this sort of noise of, you know, you should do this or you should do that from all kinds of, you know, friends, whatever. And I thought, there's just too much noise. There's just too much noise. I've got to shut it down. And around this time, a friend of mine randomly mentioned a cabin that he had in the Badlands of South Dakota. And nobody had lived in this cabin. It had just been set up on this open prairie with nothing. He said, there's nothing there. And I said, well, give me an example. What do you mean by there's nothing there? He said, the closest town is 3 miles away and has a population of 47 people. And I said, perfect. I'm going to go out there. He's like, no. You cannot go out there as a woman alone. And I said, okay, I rented my car. You know, I mean, I was like, no, sign me up. I'm going out there. I don't have a choice because nothing is coming. Right. And there's just too much noise. And so I went out there, despite all his reservations and his warnings. And there I sat for 2 months. Day one, if you remember, I had the two characters, right, from the first one that wasn't working. And I just changed everything about them and just put them in completely different contexts. And I said, go. And basically, I realized it was such a lonely place. There was such absence of sound that I realized if I had to, if I was not going to go mad in that silence, I had to write characters who I could befriend. I had to make them whole. So I'd have somebody to keep me company out there. And so basically, that was it. Me, Savita, and Purnima. And we were out there on that prairie alone. And actually, my sense of those 2 months became their 4 years, right? So time did this weird warp where we just became each other's worlds utterly. And honestly, I can't think of another way to write a novel anymore. I have to seek out, like, you know, empty planets, and you know. But yeah, I think I'll always go to very, very solitary places, because that's when, for me, the characters come. I allow there's space for them to come alive. There was electricity, and there was a cistern for water outside that had to be. Some guy would come in every couple months, so I never saw him. But there was no television, no internet, no radio, so nothing.
Did you have your phone on? Did you contact anybody?
I would, but I told all friends and whomever. I said, look, just write me letters, because I don't want voices. I don't want any other voices except for when I talk to myself aloud, which happened every day. Again, back to madness. So I just got a P.O. box in that town 3 miles away, and I opened up a P.O. box and had friends send letters. And so I'd call my mom, right, who didn't know I was out there, because she would have had a heart attack. But the beauty of cell phones. But that was it. I just shut all the noises down, all the voices. Yeah. Those were 2 months.
We were a little worried.
Yes.
So because book tours didn't work like they used to, because book reviews don't work like they used to, have you ever gone on a podcast or have a online presence like that? Like you found a, you know, person on Spotify who does book reviews, or there's someone on YouTube who's willing to offer a author interview? Mm-hmm. Like, is that a kind of publicity marketing that is something that happens now?
Yeah, I mean, my publicist, her name is Amelia, is amazing. So she's actually gotten me all kinds of stuff, including podcasts, including online, so Powell's, the bookstore in Portland, Oregon, did a blog post where I just submitted, you know, an essay on how the novel came to be. So really all avenues seem to be explored. Maybe Amy can speak more to that. But from what I've found, in addition to the on-the-ground publicity, there's been even far more, and it continues to this day, are the podcast. In fact, I'm doing one next Friday. The internet, the non-sort of getting on an airplane and going to a bookstore, that kind of stuff continues far, beyond when the book is published or the book tour.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would just say that it's just that there are a lot of those, which is great, but they're just more diffuse in terms of power to, like, if you look at sort of what will ultimately move the needle. So it's not sort of, well, if I got these five things, then it's all sort of set up.
Is there anything that you wouldn't do?
What do you mean?
Like in terms of public...
My mind went to strange places.
In terms of publicity, is there something that you would say actually that would be do more harm than good? That would be worse.
I think it's probably more for nonfiction, where you might say, you know, this show wants someone on, and then you might say that's really actually probably not the right. It's a little bit more down market than we want. But in terms of, one of my favorite publications for a book review is Women's World, which is like this really down market, I think it's like a weekly in supermarkets, probably not in New York, but in the rest of the country, but it can really move books. So I sort of feel like for fiction, all publicity is good publicity. So even if something like Us Weekly, which you might look down on, like big, huge readership. And also no one's going to sort of think, oh, because that novel was in there, as opposed to, but if you're on, like, no offense, but like if you're on the like Maury Povich show, it does sort of connote like what kind of book it is, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Cool. Next question. Yes.
You mentioned your publicist. Is that a publicist with the publishing company?
Yes. Okay. Yes, it is. And I guess at some point I did think, oh, should I get an outside publicist that I would hire? But Amelia has been so excellent and Flatiron's been so supportive. I'm like, why? I mean, it didn't make sense for me and how good Flatiron's been. But I think each author really has to, you know, decide that for themselves.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, in the front.
Thank you very much. Great session. Thank you both very much for very illuminating. I have two questions. One for Shoba, which is, well, I guess for Amy too, is what novel do you think has had the most influence on your life? And also, I'd like to ask an Amy question, which is, what sets a manuscript apart for you and gets you excited?
The questions were, what is the novel that's had the most influence on your writing, and what is in your life? Sorry. You can answer that first.
Okay. I think, well, I'm just going to have to break that up, because I really think, okay, so Elfriede Jelinek, who's an Austrian author, yeah, she actually won the Nobel Prize in Literature. She's not very well known, but the chances she takes with her, she writes a lot about the way women exist in the world. In fact, she wrote The Piano Teacher, which was made into a film. Yeah. Her work is just ruthless. I mean, it's just incredible. And I thought, you know, just tell it like it is. I mean, don't make it pretty, don't make it digestible. You know, just tell the world as you see it. And people will, you know, see their own truth in that as well. Now, in terms of my bravery in exploring certain things, I think it would have to be Elfriede Jelinek. But in terms of my writing style, I would say it's Roberto Bolaño. And when I read 2666, it changed my life. I mean, I thought, oh, I can write conversationally. Like, you know, I don't have to write in a formal, what I think literature should be. I write with that voice inside of me. I write without, you know, curbing it or formalizing it in some way. And, you know, just his stories within stories, I love that. There's so many elements of that novel that I loved. And it really was sort of, you know, epoch shifting for me. Because I thought, oh, I can write like this. I can write, you know, as if I'm talking to a friend, and that can have a real, I can really reach another heart that way. Yeah, so Roberto Bolaños is my second author. Yeah.
Oh, I think I grew up sort of I would say short stories. I mean, I was a huge Raymond Carver fan. And actually, William Carlos Williams' short stories, and actually Hemingway's short stories. I didn't love Hemingway's novels, but Hills Like White Elephants. So I thought those were, which in a way is why, you know, Sandy knew to send the novel to me, the short stories to me, because this is what I love. I would say if I had to pick a novel, it's a novella, and the sad thing is I went back and reread it, and I'm like, I can't believe I love this as much. But at the time was Goodbye Columbus, which seems sort of amazing to me when I was in 10th grade, and then you go back and read this as an adult, and you're like, oh my God, he's such a misogynist, but that's a whole other story. And I'm sorry, what was your second question?
What sets a manuscript apart and excites you?
I will say, I'm assuming most of you are aspiring writers, you know, the thing that drives me nuts is someone will say, well, no, after 30 pages, it gets good. You don't have that luxury in terms of if you're a first-time writer and you're sending something to somebody. So I used to work, when I was an assistant, I worked for an editor who literally would read the first, it was back when we'd get manuscripts as submissions, so they were physical. She would pull something off the shelf, and if she didn't like the first line, she would put it back, and that was it. Which I know sounds really harsh, but you have to realize in terms of how many submissions that an editor is getting in, I believe one of my editors the other day said that for the first 10 books she bought, she read 1,000 submissions. So if you can't hook me on that first page, and I don't mean hook in terms of like some high concept thing, but exactly what Shoba did. Shoba read those first two pages and you're just like, oh my gosh, I don't care where this woman is going. I just want to follow her, right? Like there was something different about it. I hadn't heard that story before, which is not to say that the story itself has to be some sort of like you're reinventing something, because at the end of the day, you know, for instance, a different animal, but, you know, I published this woman, Leanne Moriarty, who wrote Big Little Lies, and the first book I did of hers was this novel called What Alice Forgot, which is a novel about a woman who falls off of the bike at the gym, and instead of being a 39-year-old woman in the middle of a really acrimonious divorce, she thinks she's 29 and happily in love. The whole concept of amnesia, it wasn't like she invented that. We've all read, there have been a ton of books about that, but there was something about the voice that was really wonderful and great and funny and different. So I would say, but don't try and be different for the sake of being different. But I will, I do think that, well, I don't do the first sentence. I do do the first paragraph or first page, and I can kind of tell if I'm going to, if I sort of, and it's that thing you can't express, you can't sort of articulate it, but it's this sense of sort of magic that you feel like, oh, this person has it.
Great, thank you. Any other questions? We have time. Yep, right here.
I have a question for you, Amy. Do you have a wish list of agents? You know, do you go, oh, not this one again?
Oh, you mean of people who I don't want to have stuff with?
Yeah, or that you do.
Look, you know, I remember going home once and I was complaining about somebody to my husband, and he said, you can't get mad at someone for doing their job, which I always sort of remind myself, because the fact is, an agent's job is to be an advocate for their author. My job is to be an advocate for my authors. I think the agents who we find difficult are the ones who feel like somehow that we're on different teams rather than realizing that we're all on the same team. There are certain agents who personally I might like better than others. As an aside story, I have three daughters, my oldest of whom is 19, but when she was I think this is when she was like 16 and particularly just horrible. And I was talking to a friend of mine and he said, you need to deal with her like a very important agent who you don't like, but you need to do business with, which was actually excellent advice, parenting advice. So I will say, you know, agents are all, our industry is so small, it's all about reputation. So for instance, if Sandy sends me something, I know to look at it right away because she has exquisite taste. So I would say to you, I know if you're trying to get an agent, and sometimes actually I think getting an agent might be harder than getting actually a publishing deal. It's all about reputation. So you do really want to go to someone because again, if I'm getting 10 novels in that day, I'm going to look at the one who is from the agent who I think has the best taste because I know that that book is going to go quicker because everybody else is doing the same thing that I'm doing, which is figuring out, do I need to read this quickly? That said, some of my biggest books have been, you know, from agents who are not big names. So I don't tend to be in that, but there are certain editors who will sort of just be like, most of their books are with agents at ICM or WME or things like that. I sort of feel like, you know, one of our most exciting books next year is by like almost like a first-time agent who no one had heard of.
Great, thank you. I think we have time for one more question.
We're not.
Yes.
ICM and WME.
Oh, sure. Sorry. ICM. These are big literary agents. ICM is International Creative Management. It's a big corporate agency. WMA is William Morris Endeavor. They just tend to be those are you either have like very big agencies, which, you know, they have a film division and a scriptwriting division and a talent division and a literary division and maybe a recording division, or you might have a boutique house like Sandy Dykstra, who Sandy has, it's herself and a couple of other agents, but, you know, Sandy has done everybody from why am I? Amy Tan, you know, has really, Lisa C, like really exquisite sort of literary taste, but then also has a bunch of sort of serious nonfiction writers. And then you have sort of a lot in between where you might have a couple of like sort of mid-size agencies where there might be like, you know, maybe seven agents at the agency. There's pluses and minuses about both. I can't say to you that one is definitively better than the other. Really depends on what you're looking for. You know, again, some agents will sort of make the deal and then you never hear of them again. Some agents are involved throughout the process. Some, like Sandy, who, you know, Shoba and I were just joking because she sends these emails and they're all caps with lots of exclamations. She's like this huge cheerleader.
Every time. Yeah. Every time.
And that's kind of great, though. I mean, because it's, Shoba can speak to it. It's a really isolating, lonely business, and you want to feel like you have this team behind you. I'm speaking for you.
No, absolutely. And I think the enthusiasm that Sandy, you know, response to the emails, the all caps and the exclamation points. It's just so refreshing. It's so, I feel sort of embraced by her and by the team because there is this enthusiasm. And that's what you want, enthusiasm for your work. Because when you're feeling down and out, sitting in the Badlands, you want to, like, there's people there that've got your back.
But I will say enthusiasm with, correct me if I'm wrong, I want to say with the novel that Shoba sent in that we ended up putting aside, Sandy and I both read it and was really good because Sandy and I had a conversation where it was like a very honest, let's have this conversation before I talk to Shoba. And the worst thing for me is if I have a conversation with the agent and they're like, no, that's a brilliant novel. And you're like, well, actually, it's not. Sandy was very much on the same page with me, and that's really helpful because what Shoba doesn't want is someone who's just going to sort of tell them everything they do is fabulous and great.
God, no. No. You don't want that because, and so much of this is just putting the ego aside and saying, look, we all know that you get to an editorial point in your own work with you and the work where you're like, I can't see the forest for the trees anymore. Because I've looked at this 500 times, right? So having somebody else come in or a team of people come in and say, you know what, this, you know, you need to change this or just rewrite it. It's so helpful. And you just gotta trust. And that's what those initial phone conversations and all those were about establishing that, look, we're here for you and we've got your back. And after that, it's just, you know, once you've established that, then it's just details, right? And getting the work to where it needs to be. Yeah, if they believe in you, if you know that you're believed in, then all that is, again, part of the details of it.
And I would just add that since I'm assuming a lot of you are still trying to get representation, even though if you don't have that team, use someone around you. So, like, you finished your novel, send it to someone you really trust and have them read it. Have somebody read your cover letter that you're going to the agents with, because what you might think is a great cover letter, because you're in it, you know exactly what the novel is, you know that this completely, you know, speaks to what the novel is. Have someone who hasn't read it read your cover letter, because that's who's reading. You're having probably a 20-year-old intern at the agency, unless you have some sort of connection like Shoba did, read your cover letter. So it has to be something that speaks to someone who hasn't read anything that you've written.
Great. And I just want to end with, Shoba, what would be one thing that you would tell yourself 10 years ago as something that you know now that you wish you knew then?
Oh, wow. Ending with an easy one. I would say to my younger self that, you know, talent is ubiquitous. I mean, there's a lot of talented writers in the world. But what is not so ubiquitous, what is quite rare, is perseverance. And, you know, every single day I had to wake up and say, I'm going to continue to do this today because I want to do this. And I know, of course, the dream and the goal is to be published, but at the end of the day, you persevere because you cannot not right.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you, Shoba. Thank you, Amy. It's a wonderful panel. Thank you.